Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
I'm Mike Shackelford.
Tonight's guest is blackjack and poker guru Arnold Snyder. We'll be discussing Arnold's brand new novel, Risk of Ruin. Among other things, it's a love story where the guy in it tries to answer the age-old question, is she worth it? We'll be talking to Arnold shortly, and possibly he'll want to inject his 2 cents worth on the stuff we're talking about before then. Should he see fit to do that, he's welcome. For most, for about 6 weeks now, every week we've been citing the gambling sites which had Obama as a significant favorite in the election. One of our listeners sent in a thank you email to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Even though this guy was a Romney supporter, he saw the information we provided as an opportunity. He found a number of other Romney supporters who were willing to bet with him even money on who was going to win. Since he had the betting information and they were reading the papers that called the election too close to call, and plus those guys were willing to bet with their hearts rather than their heads, he had a significant advantage on his bets. Although our listener is still pissed about the election itself, he is happy he was able to pick up several hundred dollars using the betting information we provided here. To this, Michael and I can say you're welcome. We are intending to give you gambling information you can use, although when we designed it, it was not about elections. So, Shaq, did you make any election bets?
I certainly did. By my count, I had 14,510 on the election.
And was it all on Obama?
It was mostly on Obama. I had a couple bets on Romney to hedge my bets a little bit where I could find a good line. But yeah, the vast majority was on Obama because I honestly thought that he was going to win. And, you know, I thought it was, you know, I thought I was getting a great price.
I had two bets. One was I laid $1,200 on Obama to win $1,000, and I collected that one. The other one was an even money bet, which sounds like it's better for me, except it was a $1 bet with Shirley. I have officially won dozens of $1 bets with Shirley over the past 16 years, but I have never collected on one of them. When she wins one of these bets, she helps herself out of my wallet. Now, this doesn't seem quite fair to me, but I'm going to keep her anyway. Last week, I talked about what I thought was a pretty unusual bad beat featuring a college football game between North Carolina and North Carolina State. Michael shared his own bad beat story about a 10-year-old UNLV game. We should have known that it was likely to generate a number of emails which basically said, you think your bad beat stories were something, let me tell you about mine. Now, while we appreciate these emails and some of the bad beats sent in were pretty interesting, we decided we didn't want to feature spectacular bad beats as a regular segment on the show. However, we are putting them in the bank, so to speak, so in case we run out of things to say to our guests, we might go into that bank. With Arnold Snyder as our guest, we have no chance of running out of questions to ask him. He likes long answers. I want to talk about a relatively new process being adopted by several casinos that sounds almost like an oxymoron. Now, an oxymoron itself is a two-word self-contradictory phrase, such as jumbo shrimp. This process that casinos are using is absolutely in the house's favor. It is definitely against the player's favor overall, yet Simultaneously, it provides opportunities for players. Now, that isn't just two words, but it sure sounds self-contradictory. What I'm talking about are casino drawings where there are time periods where you can get multiple drawing entries. You're not getting multiple points. Those can usually be cashed in for money or valuable things, or money equivalents. I'm talking about a drawing where the casino has already committed to giving away a fixed amount of money, whether it's $1,000, $10,000, $100,000, or whatever. But if you play negative games on Tuesday, for example, the casino will give you 2 times drawing entries, or 5 times, or 10 times drawing entries. The reason it's against players' interest overall is we're talking about playing games where the house has the advantage, and the house is not offering to give any more. The more players play these negative games, overall, the more money players lose and the casino wins. It's clear why the house wants players to play like games like this more, because the casino's looking for the money won from the players to fund the prize pool and leave some profit left over. At the same time, playing relatively heavily on these days can provide players with an advantage over the other players in the drawing, and that advantage can be converted into real cash money when you win the drawings more than you would otherwise. If the ticket multiplier is high enough, say 10 times, then the only play that counts is really on the day where you have the multiplier. The play you do on the other days of the week, almost irrelevant. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's always smart to play for drawings, or it's always a good deal to play on ticket multiplier days. It isn't, and every case is different. But learning how to do well in drawings is every bit as important as learning how to play the games accurately. There are people who don't do drawings because they find them distasteful, they don't want to use a player's card, too much of a hassle, would rather do something else on that night, etc. That's fine. Everyone has to make their own choices, and every advantage player does it slightly different than every other advantage player. But for me, as a local player in Las Vegas, I've averaged more than $100,000 a year in drawings for the past dozen years. Figuring out how to do better for drawings is not a trivial process, and some drawings will be beneficial to me and not for you, and some will be the other way around. But it pays off when you do this. Expanding on this subject will be part of my class next Tuesday at the South Point. Another email to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com was from a listener named Greg. He wanted to know about documenting losses he's filing as a professional gambler. He wanted to know if he can use ticket stubs as proof of losses. He is a sports bettor. Now, we asked tax expert Ann Friedlefton, who was our guest on our August 9th show. If you haven't heard that show, I recommend you download it. It's free, and it's a lot of valuable tax information for gamblers. Ann responded, use the printout plus the tickets plus the diary. Just using a bunch of loser tickets reminds me of the guy who goes to the track and scoops up the tickets from the floor. There was this auditor who invoked the footprint rule. Tickets with heel marks were unacceptable. Afterwards, Annie mentioned to me that players who are audited and have merely picked up a bunch of losing tickets for bets made by others are usually easily spotted by the auditors. Keep a diary and make a printout at the end of the year summarizing what's in the diary, and you'll probably be fine. All right, let's talk to Arnold Snyder. Arnold Snyder is one of the all-time great blackjack gurus, certainly an influence on both Shaq's and my career in that game. He's been on our show several times previously, talking about his 2 poker books, his book called Topless Las Vegas, and once as a substitute co-host when Shaq was off climbing Mount Whitney with one of his Wizettes. Tonight, Arnold visits us in a new capacity as a writer of fiction. His book, Risk of Ruin, was recently published by Huntington Press, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Arnold Snyder, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, Bob. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Before we get into talking about the novel, I have a few housekeeping questions.
Okay.
First of all, your new blackjack book has been almost published for some time now. What's the latest best guess on when it'll be out?
All right. My latest best guess is probably February. The book is...
Any year in mind?
Well, yeah, it has been that long, hasn't it? I'm having a lot of computer simulations done right now, and it took me a long time to find somebody that would do it. In fact, I asked you, Michael, if you were interested.
I'm sure I shied away from it.
Yeah, everybody kind of shied away, but I've got a good programmer working on it now, and so yeah.
So the end is in sight. So
yes,
it's good, yeah. good.
So what's the book going to be about?
Well, it's titled Radical Blackjack. It's mostly going to be stories, stories from the tables, stories about things that happened to me, games I got into, how I played them, mistakes I made, things I did right, things I didn't understand at the time. A lot of it is about situations that came about due to rules I managed to play under that were unusual, and it's going to be talking about that stuff. So,
good. He shared a few of those stories with me, and I can't wait to ask him about it, but he's asked me, don't ask him about it on the air until the book comes out. So hurry up. Now, the novel identifies itself as a Vegas Lit novel. What does Vegas Lit mean?
Okay, Vegas Lit is a new fiction imprint of Huntington Press. You mentioned this was a Huntington Press book, but actually if you look at it, the logo on it is VL, and it simply says a Vegas Lit novel. I think it probably does say Huntington Press someplace in the small print inside. But it's a brand new fiction imprint. They have mostly been publishing gambling books, how-to books, guidebooks, And they have published some fiction in the past, but they decided to start a new fiction line with fiction primarily that might have to do with Las Vegas casinos or gambling thematically. And in fact, this book is the first novel to be put out on the Vegas Lit line.
And the second one coming, is that?
The second one will be Michael Koenigs, and you've had Michael on this show before.
A couple times.
Yeah, it's a great,
The man with the $100,000 breasts.
Right. And he's absolutely great gambling writer. Used to write a column for Cigar Aficionado. A good friend of mine, and his book is very funny. I have had the honor of editing that book. I'm now acting senior editor at Vegas Lit, so... we expect his book probably in the next between 4 to 6 weeks.
And it sounds like he'll be a guest on this show between the next 6 and 8 weeks.
Right.
All right.
Well, that's another book to look forward to.
For sure.
All right. The main character in your book is named Bart. And this character professes a lot of knowledge about things most of us don't know much about. However, as the author, you had to know something about these subjects too. To start, there is a debate between two characters on the relative pros and cons of Harley-Davidson and so-called Japanese motorcycles. I've never known a motorcycle rider to not have a strong opinion on this subject, one way or the other. So to start, do you have a motorcycle, and if so, what kind?
To start, I don't have a motorcycle. I've never had a motorcycle.
Unbelievable, with all the references in this book.
The main character, Bart, is based on an old friend of mine who died almost 25 years ago now, who was a very serious motorcycle nut. He was more or less related to the outlaw motorcycle faction, though he was never in any club. But if you looked at him, you would say, well, he's pretty grimy, he rides a rat bike, and he doesn't look very couth. And his name was Paladin. He is an absolutely brilliant guy, a very funny guy. And he was a very good friend of mine. And he died young. He was only 45. He said it was heart failure. I don't know if drugs were involved or whatever. But I felt like when I say base the character on him, the personality of the character is based on Paladin. But basically, the story has nothing to do with Paladin. He was never a gambler. There's a number of things, but he was a tattoo artist and a motorcycle mechanic and other aspects of that character were in Bart.
You mentioned a rat bike. What is that?
Rat bike is it's usually like a chopped Harley, or it can actually be any kind of bike, but it's a bike that has no frills. It doesn't want chrome, it doesn't want fenders. It's not doesn't particularly even look clean. It looks kind of like a greasy thing that you know most people might not want to touch. And Paladin liked motorcycles like that. He just liked that kind of that grimy outlaw look to him. So.
Well, can you play the devil's advocate and explain this elitism that Harley riders have? Like I heard they won't even wave to another rider if he's not on a Harley.
Well, you see, being that I don't ride motorcycles, I don't really get into that. You mentioned there is an argument between it's between Bart and a guy named Jersey Jimmy in here who is riding. Oh no, this argument is with Johnny the Jap, who's riding a Honda, a big Honda, and the argument has to do with just like Harley culture versus the Japanese bike culture. It's actually an argument that I literally, now again, this was probably more than 25 years ago, but I heard this argument and variations on this argument numerous times when I was hanging out with Paladin because he called Japanese bikes, egg beaters and rice burners, and you know he just had a lot of his own terminology for bikes like that. He had no respect for them whatsoever. That's where it comes from.
All right.
At least they're not as noisy as Harleys.
Oh, sounds like he rides a rice burner. Okay, good. So in addition to being a biker and a tattoo artist, he's also a current atheist and former Satanist, and a whole card reader in blackjack. Now we know where you have that information from. Now he was a lockpick. Now he's a high school dropout who has one hell of a vocabulary and all these literary references that most college graduates don't have. Now, how much of Bart is autobiographical?
Bart is not really autobiographical. Actually, Paladin himself was, I'm sure his IQ was well above mine. He was probably one of the most well-read people that I'd ever met, and especially in any subject that had to do with history. He knew everything there was to know about weapons, whether you're talking guns, bombs, knives. He was also a knife maker. I really did base the personality of that character on Paladin. Now, Paladin was not, to my knowledge, ever into lockpicking, and that comes from one of my own old passions. I was really into magic, and a lot of magicians, and especially when you're young, you get interested in the escape tricks and how Houdini did it, and I read a lot about that, and I got a set of lock picks, and I used to sit around with my magic buddies, and we'd try picking locks and things like that. The method that's in there on how to pick a pair of, literally pick your way out of a pair of police handcuffs, is actually the way that you would pick your way out of a pair of police handcuffs.
If you were handcuffed behind your back and you had the lock picks hidden in the belt,
no.
And all those kind of things.
The answer is no. I can't pick. I can't even pick your door lock. At one time maybe I could sort of do it if I spent about 20 minutes, but I never really developed the art. But I have a lot of respect for those people who can.
All right. So Bob mentioned that the character in this book is a Satanist, and the way the book portrays it is Satanism is basically doing what feels good as long as you're not hurting anybody else. It seemed rather benign. So, I mean, can you educate the audience on what at least the character thought it was?
Okay, let me get into where that came from. Again, this comes from my own experience. Paladin, who I based Bart on, to my knowledge, Paladin was not a Satanist. Very likely he was an atheist. I don't think I ever mentioned or talked anything about religion with him. This is actually based on my own unique childhood. At the age of 14, in the ninth grade, I entered a Catholic seminary, studying to be a priest. And
failed.
I did. I made the mistake of reading the Old Testament, And Catholics don't really read the Bible. I went to Catholic schools, you know, all through the eighth grade, you know, was taught by nuns and priests and, you know, but they don't really read the Bible much. Well, I read the Old Testament and I didn't like God. And I went and I talked to one of the priests there, because here I'm studying to be a priest. And I said, I don't like God. I read this, you know, this is horrible. He's absolutely, and he is. I mean, if you read Deuteronomy, all he's doing, he tells the Jews, go over here to the Canaanites and chop them up with your swords, every oxen, every ass, and take the children for your slave. You know, and I'm like, they're chopping up donkeys. You know, who is this God that's telling them to do this? You know, you're the chosen people. These aren't. They're the bad guy. And I told this priest, I said, this is the absolutely most horrible. And he said, well, look, you know, you have to read that. Don't read it and think this is literally what happened. These are stories. The Bible is God's word, but these are stories he wants you to read. And so that you can figure out what the message is that he's trying to give you. So I went back and I read the entire Old Testament, start to front. And this was, again, I was 14 years old. This was 1962. And in the late 50s and early 60s, two television shows that I was addicted to, one was The Twilight Zone and the other one was Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And both of them had twist endings. And yes. So now I'm reading the Old Testament. I'm trying to figure out, is there like a twist to this? Is there? And I came up with what I thought was had to be. And I went back and I told the priest and I said, look, this is what I think. If this is really the word of God, I think what God did was he wanted to see if people would worship a God that was evil. And anybody that would worship this God had to be a hypocrite and not worthy of going to heaven. And the only really, the most courageous person in the entire Old Testament was Lucifer, because he said, no, I refuse. And I said, you know, God is just like an egomaniac in this thing, just goes around slaughtering. And I said, you know, I think, you know, this is what the explanation is. And he didn't like my explanation.
No, really?
But I actually couldn't get away from it. I just felt like, you know, I mean, now, it's not like today I believe that the Bible was, you know, written by God or the word of God because he wanted us to, you know, I really did imagine Rod Serling's voice at the end of the, judgment day coming, you know, the human race has entered the Twilight Zone. It's just like, but you know, that's where Bart's vision of Satan came from. He actually saw Satan as the good guy.
All right, so let's get away from religion before I get too many emails in my inbox and I can possibly deal with. So let's get back to the novel.
Preach it, brother.
All right,
go ahead.
Now, on the other side of the love story, we find Stacy, who is a brilliant teenager who dropped out of Stanford University and is running away from mom and dad. She's 25 years or so younger than Bart, has fake ID, and works as a stripper, and somehow gets all of Bart's obscure literary references. She has very unusual godlike powers. Tell us more about Stacy.
Okay, well, Stacy is actually also based on primarily on my first wife. And my first wife was clinically schizophrenic. And the things that Stacy says about being God and creating everything and being responsible for everything, this was actually all stuff that came out of my first wife's mouth. And it was, you know, and we were together for 10 years. Now, you know, we got married in 1967, so our marriage ended around 1977 or 78, around there. So I am, you know, it's not like this was recent, but I lived with her for a long time. And a lot of Stacy's character I based on her, because she was, to me, very fascinating. And, you know, that's pretty much, you know, where she's coming from.
All right. Hole carding is very key to the plot of this book. And this is a topic we've talked about on the show quite a few times. But for the benefit of our less than devout listeners, can you explain what hole carding is and where it fits into the book?
Yeah, Bart actually is trained as a hole carder by his old biker friend Clance, who was in Reno at the time, and then they end up going to Vegas. The hole card stuff that I wrote in there is actually all pretty accurate to the way that hole carding is done and the way they think about it and the way that it goes on. I talk about the wars between, like, hole carding is often done in teams or small groups of players who work together, and there's counter teams that are actually trying to rip off each other's signals. And I mean, there's a lot of possibilities for getting into fights in the hole carding community. In fact, there have been some really pretty drastic things that have happened between, you know, these players who supposedly are all working against the casinos. Card counters aren't usually like that. Card counters are a lot less, physically violent or angry with each other or whatever. Hole carders are kind of as a group are much more let me put it this way. Part of it has to do with the difficulty of finding games. Hole carders have to scout for a long time, a lot of hours, just to find a single dealer that they can catch a hole card on. They have to get the right seat. They have to be there at the right time. They have to hope that there's not too many players on the table to make it, a waste of time because of just on the number of hands they're getting or the difficulties. So it's an art form. It's probably, I would say, that of the serious professional blackjack players playing today, there may be more hole carders now than there are card counters, because the games have gotten so bad for card counters, and they have just continually gotten better for hole card players, primarily because of all of the 6-5 blackjack games that are now being dealt from single decks, and those are the most ideal games for hole carders, and that 6-5 poor payout doesn't affect them much. And then all the what they call the carny games, like the three-card poker and all the different forms of Texas Hold'em and, all of these games where a dealer can conceivably flash a card, even if it's not a hole card. He might be flashing one of his cards in a three-card poker game, and that can give a player a substantial advantage. The stuff I wrote in there about hole carding is fairly accurate to the way that it's done.
A related question has to do with indexing. And I had not heard of indexing before I read your book. Now, how does that play into this?
There are dealers who, again, this is something that happens in a single deck game. And again, they find a dealer and then they find one other one. Dealers who flash the index of the next card to be dealt are rare. But they do exist. I've talked to hole card players, and some of them will tell me, yeah, I've only seen one or two in my life, but man, when you find one, it's great. It has to do with the casino procedure. They have a protection procedure in the casinos where the dealer, after he deals a card, he's supposed to take the deck and pull it up to his chest. And in a single deck game, the bottom card would be covered because he puts cards upside down onto the bottom. And basically it's that's where they want the dealer to sit there with the deck up to his chest. Well, some dealers, their thumb that's holding the deck in their left hand moves slightly, almost like getting ready to deal the next top card. And if he pushes it just ever so slightly, you can start to see the index on the card. And that is basically the next card to be dealt. And some dealers, and again, they're very rare, but when you find a dealer like this, he's like money in the bank, because even if you can't get the whole card, if you know the next card to be dealt, that is a huge, huge
advantage. And it's coming to
advantage.
You. If it's coming to you.
Or if it's...
Or a partner.
Right. In other words... players who play that dealer that does this can do the kind of strategies, and then these types of things are explained in the book. If you know the next card to come, that you would try to steer. You might, if there's more than one player at the table, you might steer that card away from a player that would bust, and maybe a player that has a small bet could take that card. You might see that, oh, this will bust the dealer and the dealer has to take a hit. Now, you would only know this if, in fact, you knew the dealer, you knew the whole card. But, you know, there's a lot of strategies, and actually knowing the next card to be dealt is a stronger play than knowing the dealer's whole card.
And you hope that the ace that you see coming isn't really a four, and you just...
Right. Yeah, things like that. Yeah, there are mistakes that can be made. You can see the rounded corner and think it, you know, that maybe that's a three, and in fact it's a queen or something like that. But, you know, that depends on how he's angling it or whatever. But, you know, it's a legitimate strategy. It's not played very often. Probably whole card players would be the only ones who would ever even notice it, because they've constantly got their eyes peeled for things like that.
When I first moved to Vegas 11 years ago, I did a lot of whole carding and three card poker, and now I find it very, very difficult to find a good game.
Well, the casinos have gotten hip to it, especially at three-card poker, because there are numerous books that have come out. I think...
including yours and mine, Michael.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So you guys have written about this. I think Stanley Coe wrote the first book explaining what the edge would be if you could see one of the dealer's cards at three-card poker. You know, since then, a number of other books have come out. I think Avery Cardoza has a book out on three-card poker. You know, the game got more popular, and the strategies became known. And, you know, once you've got books being published, well, the casinos can read the books, and they're much more careful now. I've noticed a lot of the three-card poker games now, they have the dealing shoe, the mechanical dealing shoe that spits the cards out. A lot of those are much lower now to the table height, whereas they used to be sitting up on the table, and, you know, the dealer kind of had to make sure he angled the cards down so the players didn't see them. I mean, when the first players discovered it, there were a lot of opportunities, and a lot of, you know, the casinos now know how players do that at that game.
And another thing you were too polite to mention to Michael is his eyes are 11 years older now than they were then.
That probably has something to do with it, too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. It's my turn. Oh, some of the story takes place near the Area 51 test site. Was this just for convenience of the narrative to the story, or do you have a personal interest in Area 51 and whatever goes on there?
I really don't have that much of a personal interest in Area 51, insofar as I'm not really crazy about the ideas of going out looking for flying saucers and aliens, and probably because most of the time when I've ever on TV or something, I've seen somebody saying, yeah, I saw that. It usually looks like a type of person that I would say, I don't know, I would trust this guy's opinion. But it's sort of like I'm not much into that kind of stuff, seriously. I think I'm just too practical of a person. So basically Area 51 was convenient. It was halfway between Reno and Vegas, more or less, and it was, you know, close enough that, you know, on a motorcycle trip they could, you know, sort of be out there So it ended up being, I actually drove out there to see what it was like. You know, you can't go into Area 51. My understanding is if you actually cross into it, you will be surrounded in a very short time, that they have some kind of sensors or something that basically protect that area. It is a government-controlled area, and they don't want any strangers in there, so...
What is the significance of the title Risk of Ruin?
Okay, I'm sure you're familiar with the term Risk of Ruin. It's a gambler's term, sometimes just referred to as gambler's ruin. Statisticians came up with a formula for estimating what percentage of the time you will go broke if you employ a certain strategy in a certain game. It's used rather loosely in this book to describe just somebody that loses everything, and I think it's almost like I think on the back cover here, the back cover, it says Risk of Ruin's a provocative story of, you read this, okay. It's tormented gambling men since Adam placed that all-in bet on Eve. Is she worth the risk? And so what we have here is whether or not Bart should be putting everything on Stacy, or is he, you know, what's his risk of ruin?
One of my many pet peeves is when people draw a die and you can see two adjacent sides adding up to seven. It should be two opposite sides adding up to seven. And on your book cover, we can see a one and a six adjacent to each other. So can we attribute this to character error, error of the artist who drew the book, or will you cope to some blame for not catching it?
I actually immediately saw that one of the dice had a six and a one, that you could see both of them, which is would be an impossible since they would be on opposite sides of the dice, of the die. But I saw it, but the artist, and I attributed it to an error the artist made, probably because he wasn't familiar with dice and the way dice numbers were set up. And I decided to just leave it because my feeling was what you're looking at really is the tattoo that that this biker has on his arm. And I suspect there are probably a lot of tattoo artists out there, some of whom aren't really all that sure of, you know, how the dice numbers are set up, or even if they really don't even care. And so I decided to just leave it because I thought, you know, that's something that the tattooist could have done.
Your bread and butter, writing-wise, has been nonfiction. Writing fiction's a whole different ballgame. Which are you enjoying more now, and do you plan to continue writing fiction?
Actually, I do plan to continue writing fiction. I'm having a lot of fun writing fiction. I have another novel I'm working on right now. And I think it's more fun to write fiction than it is to write nonfiction. I've been writing nonfiction for more than 30 years, mostly about gambling. You know, I have written a number of books on how to solve Sudoku puzzles, and
those are good books, by the way, folks. I really learned a lot from them.
Yeah, but fiction is fun. Writing fiction is almost like, you know, playing God, because you create the world, you create the characters, you create exactly what's happening. You can go anywhere with it, and it's there's a fun factor to that. Like, can you make this? Can you come up with a story that's really crazy, but somehow it's convinced people that this really could have happened? And I find that fun.
Now, you have a new website called writeaholic.com, which is mostly you writing nonfiction analysis about fiction.
So, right.
And I look at it regularly, and you invest a lot of time in that.
Yeah, I'm enjoying that. It's a blog. I put up two or three posts a week. Usually once a week I'll review a novel or a collection of short stories. And I've also published half a dozen or so of my own short stories on there. And then I've also written a couple of essays, thoughts on writing. My writing career actually began with writing fiction, and this was back in the early 70s, from 1971 to 1973 or so, 1974. I was basically just a hack writer. I was writing anything I could get money for. And so I was writing porno novels for the types of books you'd see in adult bookstores. I don't even know if they have them anymore, because I don't know if anybody reads anymore. But, you know, it used to be there was a company in San Diego called Greenleaf Classics. And I wrote, I was writing novels for them, and I was writing stories for, like, the Women's Confession and Romance magazines, you know, like, you know, True Story, True Confessions. Those are the main ones. I never even got into them. Those were paying 5 cents a word. I was writing for the ones that paid, you know, 2 cents a word, like Inside Story and, you know, whatever.
So an 800-word article would give you $16.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and in fact, for that's
a hard way to make a living.
Yeah, and it was. Now again, we're talking 40 years ago, so money was a little bit different then. I have no idea what they're paying now. They probably pay the same, you know. But back then, yeah, it was really churning out a lot. And we were also writing. We were living in Berkeley. I was living with my wife. This was with my first wife, the one who was schizophrenic, and she was also a writer. And she was writing the same things I was. She was better on the female pulp fiction, and I was better on the male pulp fiction. But we both wrote both of them, and then edited both, you know, each other's. I mean, actually, it was an education in writing and you know, plot and things like. Not that there's a whole lot of plot especially in the porno novels, which are just one sex scene after another. They're really kind of almost like reading a comic book or something. There's no character development. No, they don't want character development.
Well, unless the development in terms of inches and bra size or something.
Right, yeah. And then we were also writing papers. There was a company across the street. We were living in Berkeley. There was a company across the street from the university that was selling, it was called something like Term Papers Unlimited or something like that. But what they were doing is they would write papers for students. And I can go in there and get an assignment, and they'd say, okay, we need a book report on James Baldwin's native son. And I'd say, oh, okay, I got that book at home. I can read that. I'll write a report. And they'd pay you like, $5 a page or something. And you'd write. And in fact, I wrote a lot of book reports for books I didn't even read. Because, some books you don't even really have to read the book. I mean, if you're a writer, you can read certain sections of a book and decide, okay, I'll say this is really important, you know. But, you know, and then they also would pay us to go to classes and take notes on the classes, and that didn't pay much either. But we'd go sit in classes at Berkeley and take notes, and they would, you know, they would assign us classes, and they would sell the notes to students who are skipping classes. And that always like kind of cracked me up that, like, you know, first of all, I didn't have a college education, but I was a writer, so I could
do
this.
You do now.
So, yeah. Well, you know, I was,
no degree, but you have a college education.
Yeah. But so we would just sort of like, we would write anything. If it would make money for us, we were like, you know, I didn't want to go to work and she didn't want me to go to work. But the thing is, I eventually, I got so burned out on the hack writing. The pay was so low that I eventually ended up going to the post office and getting a job. It was like, it was just easier on me. It was easier on my brain to just do that.
I heard Stephen King once said, there's two signs of a good writer. Number one, someone will pay him for what he writes. And number two, the check clears.
That's pretty good.
All right, so we're going to take some breaks now and talk about and pay some bills. We got a few more questions for you if you have time to stick around.
I'll be here.
All right, good. This was interesting. Michael, what did we learn tonight?
I did not know that Arnold was once studying to be a priest. I find that very interesting. It's something I'd like to talk more about it sometime.
And hopefully not on the air. I've had four people come up and tell me, don't have Shaq talk about religion on the air. But anyway, that's another subject.
Wait a minute. So you're already talking about religion on the air.
Oh, we had the Holy Rollers on a few weeks ago. You know them.
Oh, the blackjack players.
Yeah, some people thought I was hard on them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, some people were right. All right, good. I actually didn't know what indexing was, or I hadn't. Once they explained it, goes, oh, yeah, I can see how that would be useful. I had never been paying much attention to that before. But yes, I could see how that would be very interesting. All right. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else. Every Tuesday in November, they'll have two drawings, 4:15 and 8:15. At each drawing, 20 names will be chosen based on play during the week. Each name called gets to spin a 20-position wheel where there are 13 chances to get 1,000. five chances to get 5,000 and two chances to get 10,000. Maximum tickets will be earned by playing $250 coin in each day. This is a good low roller promotion for locals who can be there every day and play at least $250. Your chances aren't great in winning, but if you're a low-stakes player, they're likely better here than they are at drawings where players can earn thousands of tickets by playing more money than you can afford. On Thanksgiving Day, there'll be 2x points on video poker and 5x points on slots, midnight to midnight on VIT, with no limits. Players who play at least $400 in slots or $1,000 in video poker from this Sunday, the 11th, for the following week, can pick up a free frozen turkey between Monday, the November 19th, and Wednesday, November 21st. This coming Tuesday at noon, I'll be teaching a class called What Video Poker Players Should Know About Slot Clubs. This class compares the slot clubs at South Point, Coast, Station, Palms, Harrah's, etc. It allows you to figure out which casinos best fit your needs the best. Part of the discussion is how to do well in drawings, which we briefly mentioned earlier on this show. At the Palms, every Friday and Saturday in November at 7 p.m., they have a James Bond theme as a tie-in to a new Skyfall movie, and there's drawings with this theme. The top five places earn these silver briefcases, which hold between a top prize of $6,000 and a bottom prize of $500. Five additional places earn either $300 or a James Bond 50th anniversary Blu-ray box set. You earn double drawing entries on Tuesday and Sundays, which is what prompted my earlier discussion on this general topic. The PEW, Play, Earn, and Win, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, prizes for the first half of the month have a vintage touch theme, where prizes are an old-time look pay telephone, several clocks, a lunchbox, a gumball machine, and my personal favorite, a turtleneck dickie. The second half of the month will feature a theme of gifts for everyone, where the top prize seems to be a $50 Visa gift card. The details of the free monthly drawing at videopoker.com are that it'll be November 24th to the 30th. The game will be Spin Fever. Spin Fever is an 8-coin per line game where you earn spins for every flush or better that you end up with. One counter is for flushes, one counter is for full houses, and one counter is for bigger than that. Any time after you've earned your spin, you can spin the wheel. If the wheel ends up on 100 for full houses and you have six of them so far, then you get 600 coins. The Wizard of Oz website, there's a nice write-up on this game explaining the strategies, or the how you can calculate the strategy and what the return is for the game. The strategy varies tremendously. The added value for a flush is about 90 coins. Normally, a flush is going to pay 25 or 50. So all of a sudden, instead of flushes being worth 25 or 30, they're worth 100 or so. That changes the strategy significantly. You're going to be holding a lot of flush kickers. The change between a 3-card royal and a 4-card flush, always go for the 4-card flush. You're probably even going to hold 2-pair where one of the pair is aces. So there are games where you just pick the aces. Not in this game. This game where you get this extra spin for full houses, you're going to pick the 2-pair. But anyway, that's going to be their game of the month. Next week, our guest will be Willie Allison. Willie is a surveillance expert. He started out in Australia and he's worked in this country quite a bit. He runs a surveillance conference every February here in Las Vegas. I believe Michael has spoken on it at least once, and Elliot Jacobson has spoken on it, and Elliot's going to be our guest in several weeks. So we'll be asking Willie. One of the things we're going to be asking him is when surveillance thinks they found a advantage player, and then they send out that guy's picture to all the other casinos in the world, basically ruining his chances to continue his profession. Does he have any moral or ethical problems with that?
And I'm curious as to what his answer is going to be. Probably in 2 weeks. No, I'm start over again on that. In 2 weeks is Thanksgiving. Michael and I decided we're going to enjoy Thanksgiving dinner rather than showing up here. We're going to be rerunning one of our shows, probably the one from last week, with Stacey Alonzo Colombo and Chris Bruni from IGT. And in 3 weeks is probably going to be Bob Nersessian, who is the top gaming lawyer in Las Vegas, or maybe in the country. All right, Arnold. There's a lot of drugs subculture in this book, and on whiteaholic.com, you seem to be attracted to old hippies and Jack Kerouac and people with these drug-induced writing. Now, you, of course, when you say you spent significant time at Berkeley, well, that kind of fits in. Are you an old hippie? And
I was a young hippie, and now I'm an old hippie. So, that's actually the truth.
So you did inhale at one time or another.
At one time, yeah. One time I inhaled, and I also took quite a bit of LSD. And, that was what life was back in 67, 68.
Clearly it proves you can be a great blackjack counter if you take LSD. I mean, the proof seems clear.
Absolutely. Absolutely clear.
One thing I'd like to turn back on is the election, and I applaud this reader who wrote in who is getting even money bets on Obama, and I think that's one of my favorite tricks is trying to find really juicy bets like that. And I remember I had an even money bet on Clinton when he ran against Dole, and I don't know what the odds were, but that was just a runaway election. And I had a $500 bet on that, which at the time for me in '96 was a really big bet. So always keep your eye out for opportunities like that if you don't mind taking advantage of a friend a little bit.
Oh, well, friends are who you bet with. One reason to like rich friends is because they can afford to lose bigger bets.
Yeah, I have a good friend who lives in Florida, and he, after the election, he said he was stunned at the result. And my response was, stunned? How could you be stunned? Every sports book was, putting Obama a favorite, a 4-to-1 favorite. What is there to be surprised at?
He probably didn't look at the sports books.
He didn't.
One thing that kind of bothered me is on the news, in all the days leading up to the election, they kept saying it was a nose-to-nose horse race, which was just not true.
Well, it was a nose-to-nose horse race if you're looking at the popular vote.
Right, but that's I don't understand why everyone puts such an emphasis on the popular vote when it doesn't make one bit of difference.
Well, that happens to be the truth of what it is in this country. It's the way elections work. It's the way, presidential elections anyway. So
I don't know. Has Donald Trump conceded yet? Is like he does he still think it's up for grabs? he seemed to have a problem.
Well, he's probably
with
still trying to avoid Obama's birth certificate. And I don't know what would happen if that happened.
I don't know. So you have a date back here again in February when your book comes out. And
I'll be here.
When Koenig's book comes out, I don't know if you want to hold his hand while he's in the story, or just he's pretty good at holding it by himself.
Michael can talk.
when some of our authors, we said, we'll give you the questions in advance, and Michael says, I don't care what you ask, just whatever you want to ask, I'll do it. He used to be in improv comedy where they would take suggestions from the audience and he would go with it. And so he's very good at thinking on his feet, and he doesn't really care what you ask him. All right, thank you everybody for being here. See you next week. Lots of royal flushes.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.